This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for April 2010. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. This month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we're going to hear poems by Randall Mann.
He slid the stiff blade up to my ear.
Kathy Park Hong.
Can't bacchanal and garland alas, can't at last brag and crack laws, balls.
And a narrative poem by H.L. Hicks.
Barns burn, it turns out, just the way you'd think if you thought about it.
A few years ago, we asked a few poets in the April issue to explain what was going on in their poems, and we printed our questions and their explanations after the poems in the issue.
People really liked it, so we're revisiting it this year. The whole issue is devoted to poems followed by Q&As. And we're doing this because a lot of times when we look at a poem, we read them just like everybody else does, and we wonder why things look the way they do on the page or what something means. And when we're stumped by something, we're in a unique situation because, unlike a lot of our readers, we can just get an explanation or clarification directly from the poets themselves.
So we thought we'd actually formalize that process a bit this month and bring those explanations into the issue. We have other poems and explanations by Ray Armantrout and Donald Revelle, Emily Warren, Robin Schiff, and several others.
But for the podcast, we'll do just what we always do. We'll play some poems read by the poets, and then we'll talk about them behind their backs.
First up, we have Randall Mann, a poet from San Francisco and the author of Breakfast with Tom Gunn. His poem, The Fall of 1992, is set in Gainesville, Florida.
He was an undergraduate there in 1992, which was the year that Madonna's CD Erotica came out.
And so did I. And so that was a kind of my soundtrack for this fall.
That was a pretty big deal when that CD came out and when the book came out that went with it. Another reference in the poem from around that time is Lady Pearl,
who was the house drag queen at the gay bar I frequented, the University Club. She was this amazing sort of fiery presence, and when she approved of something, I remember she would always bark, "Get you a cocktail!"
Here's Randall Mann reading The Fall of 1992.
An empire of moss, dead yellow, and carapace. That was the season of gnats, amyl nitrate, and goddamn rain. Of the gator in the fake lake, rolling his silverish eyes. Of vice, of erotica, give it up and let me have my way. And the gin-soaked dread that an acronym was festering inside. Love was a doorknob statement, a breakneck goodbye. And the walk of shame without shame, the hair disheveled, curl of cools, and desolate birds like ampersands. I redid my face in the bar bathroom, above the urinal trough. I liked it rough. From behind the stall, Lady Pearl slurred the words, "Don't hold out for love."
Well, you can't read a poem like this without thinking of Tom Gunn, and it's interesting that the title of Randall Mann's book is Breakfast with Tom Gunn. And, you know, one of the ways that Gunn used to contain uncontainable experience and rough experience was with tight forms. And interestingly, this poem is in syllabics, and you wouldn't even notice if you didn't sit down and count the syllables, but each line of each stanza corresponds with the others and has the same number of syllables, and it's as if he's found a way of, after all these years, of containing an experience that was clearly wild.
Too many drugs and too many boys and too many black out nights. I look back and it's sort of like this strange fog, an amazing sequined fog.
Part of what's contained in the experience and in the poem is this acronym that's festering inside, which would be AIDS or HIV.
Yeah, and it's appropriate. I remember when we read the poem, we puzzled over what the acronym was for a bit. You know, it's not exactly obvious.
And the gin-soaked dread that an acronym was festering inside.
And he discloses it in the Q&A. As you think about the poem, as you experience the poem, it is appropriate that it's sort of hidden like that, mm-hmm. because that was the fear.
Yeah, it's really festering inside the poem, and in within the poet, there's something about the way this took over that period of time and took on a life of its own and took lives in that process.
Yeah. It's interesting that he quotes Madonna, too. I couldn't help but hear Johnny Cash in the beginning, An Empire of Moss, because, you know, that An Empire of Dirt, you know, a famous song from Johnny Cash.
And you could have it all,
as if he's turning Johnny Cash's masculinity on its head. Let's hear another poem by Randall Mann. This one is also about sex, but in this case it appears to be some kind of S&M role-playing. It's called Straight Razor.
He slid the stiff blade up to my ear. Oh, fear, this should have been thirst, a cheapening act. But I lacked, as usual, the crucial disbelief. Sticky, cold, a billfold wet in my mouth, wrists bound by his belt. I felt like the boy in a briny night pool, he who found the drowned body, yet still somehow swam with an unknown joy. That boy.
That poem's kind of scared me when I read it.
Yeah, it's spooky. It's spooky. It sets up a scene of role-playing, but then ends with this drowned body.
Yeah. Again, what Randall Mann is so good at is the permutations of these things so that body and joy become boy. So there's always something not only dangerous, but also kind of luminous in what he's doing. There's a lot of talk or complaint about confessional poems, you know, poems that just are about oneself or experiences at a particular time. And what Randall Mann does so well is he retains the mystery as well as the danger in these experiences. So they're not just some kind of, you know, diary entries. They really take on all kinds of freighted things.
And they link back to the making of art itself.
But I lacked, as usual, the crucial disbelief.
And we asked him in the Q&A afterwards, he mentioned not being able to suspend disbelief, which mm-hmm. is Coleridge's famous phrase. And Coleridge was talking about this state of mind that you need to have in order to be able to understand poetry. You have to be able to suspend disbelief. And we asked him if the poem could be in some way about poetry as well as about this role-playing and not being able to assent to this role-playing. And he said, I suppose it's about the limitations of artifice and what happens when one has a lack of, quote, poetic faith, he's quoting Coleridge, in a painstaking sexual setup. So he draws a very clear connection between the making of art and the sexual scene.
Yeah, it's painstaking and painful.
In 2007, Kathy Park Hong came out with her book Dance, Dance Revolution about a futuristic city called the Desert, where exploited migrant workers from all over the world had developed the strange American Creole in which most of the poems are written.
Clap away, Greek chorus, a gay, sashaying crowd. Clap away, chatty flackman, Neprina Pacman.
Now Kathy Park Hong is writing a book of ballads about imaginary boomtowns in the American West, and we have two poems from that upcoming book in the April issue. The poem we're about to hear is about a recurring character in the book called Our Jim.
And he is half Apache, half white, and he travels with this band of brothers to this boomtown in California, and it's a kind of an introductory poem about him.
Here's Kathy Park Hong reading Our Jim.
In this world hacked from marrow dust, the half-breed assassin slays men before they breed to core. He belts his innard song. He travels to a sapling town where sawyers hew logs to songs of plovers and mansadors tame broncs of the blackest, lustiest blood. Soon the town blooms to terror and fades before it blooms. Ghosts weed out of bodies with their sharp, imagined hands. A hobbled miner, delirious from the sun, feels the shadow of his innard song and croaks, I'm a buck nun failure anyway. The half-breed leaves him be, rides to a town of tents wooled with alfalfa, and glass-needled rain shatters the dusted tundra.
Well, there were a couple things we wanted to ask her about.
The vocabulary, yeah. First of all, that's one thing you have to ask Kathy about, first of all. So, you know, what's a buck nun? Do you know, Don?
I didn't know until we got the answer from the poet. I never would have known that a buck nun is a solitary bachelor.
I just like reading the dictionary, and I thought it was just funny. It's such a fun, ridiculous word that I had to use it.
Yeah, and mansador is another word for caballero or vaquero. It's a tamer of horses, essentially someone who breaks horses.
Well, there are a lot of words in here that are used for their sounds, and I guess Kathy Park Hong tries to take some pleasure in I guess, the sounds of the words and maybe their histories as well.
What I love about these lines where you can feel her just moving so slowly over the sounds and so carefully. He travels to a sapling town where sawyers hew logs to songs of plovers.
Yeah, that sounds really good. It's funny, there are always questions about how to reinvigorate rhyme or the other kinds of devices in a poem. And there's some terrific rhyming in her poems, things like alfalfa and tundra. That's very evocative, just where the words themselves really chime in together, maybe even accidentally, I don't know, but they do create a rich landscape here.
Yeah. I think this poem fits into a larger narrative sequence. It reads sort of like Cormac McCarthy. In a poetic version of Cormac McCarthy, you've got this half-breed assassin who goes around killing people before they become too many people, killing mm-hmm. men before they can breed into too many men. There's some kind of bizarre humor in the poem in that he spares this person at the end because he's a bachelor. I'm a buck nun failure anyway, and so the half-breed assassin leaves that one be. So,
I kept thinking of these Clint Eastwood westerns to help guide me through some of this poem, you know, the landscape of it, that there are these strange bachelor figures and half-breed people wandering around shooting it out.
Yeah, and then the other poem that we have fits into that. It's also a part of the sequence. It's called Ballad in A.
Looking at the poem, you quickly notice that the only vowel used is the letter A. That makes it a lipogram, which is a literary work with the constraint of not using a particular letter or group of letters.
And in fact, this poem uses the letter A in every single word. And there have been entire lipogram novels. There have been several written by writers associated with members of the Oulipo group in France who experimented with all kinds of formal restraints. I think the most famous one here would be Georges Perec, who wrote an entire novel without the letter E.
So here Kathy Park Hong is combining these Oulipo forms with her Western ballads. And in spite of this constraint, Ballad in A tells a Wild West story.
It's basically a fight that happens. A very useless and unnecessary fight between a Kansan and a marshal. And then they both end up shooting each other dead.
So here's Kathy Park Hong's lipogram, Ballad in A.
A Kansan plays cards, calls Marshall a crawdad. That barb lands that rascal a slap. That Kansan jackass scats, camps back at Caballada Ranch. Hangs cack, axe, and camp hat. Kansan's nag mad and rants, can't bask. Camp Bacchanal and Garland, alas, can't at last brag and crack laws, balls. Kansan's cantata rang at that Ramada ranch. Manana, Kansan snarls, I'll have an armada and thwart law's brawn, slam law a damn mass warpath. Marshall's a marksman, maps Kansan's track, calm as a shaman, sharp as a hawk, says that dastard Kansan's had, and gnaws lamb fatback. At dawn, Marshall stalks at ranch, packs a gat, and blasts Kansan's ass. And Kansan gasps, blasts back. A flag flaps at half-mast.
I don't know how she read that.
Yeah, well, you can tell from her laughter that it's a poem that's, you know, it's got a sense of humor to it.
Yeah.
The inevitable question is, you know, what's the point of a poem like this? I mean, why use the letter A in every single word, Don?
Here's my theory about this. You know, she talks about how reading up for this kind of poem, she was looking at work by Zane Grey and Larry McMurtry and Miner's Diaries and watching Western movies. And, you know, the thing is, all of those have a certain kind of form, too. And you could argue that those forms are just as arbitrary as anything else. You know, why is a Western novel by Zane Grey formulaic the way it is? It has an appeal to it. And people engage in these forms all the time. We know exactly what to expect in a Western movie. She's just importing that kind of thinking to a poem, but having fun with it, too. Right. I mean, sort of highlighting or pointing out the weird artifice that's in these forms that we do take for granted and kind of enjoy. So she's just spinning it around and trying to make your head spin.
Yeah, it squeezes your material through a very particular point, and so it makes something different on the other side. You know, A.R. Ammons once in Tape for the Turn of the Year, of course, wrote an entire book on adding machine tape because he wanted to see what happened when he made the poem adjust to material conditions completely outside of itself. So the lines are determined by the adding machine tape.
And it's a technique that poets take advantage of all the time. She says that she's a lexical integrationist. So she's taking all these words and trying to integrate them. And this is, in the form of a poem, a great way to do it.
Yeah. H.L. Hicks is a poet who teaches at the University of Wyoming, and we have something of a departure for him in their April issue.
It's a prosy narrative poem that Hicks told us originated in a dream.
I don't have a very active dream life in the sense of remembering very much when I wake up, but this time, this dream was very, very vivid, and most of the details that occur in the poem, very many of them were in the dream itself.
Well, aside from the fact that it comes from some dream plot and imagery, H.L. Hicks told us that, if anything, this is influenced by the Southern Baptist sermons that he heard twice a week when he was growing up and, you know, having to listen to the kind of language that's in the King James Version of the Bible.
So this is a little bit longer poem than we usually have on our podcast, but it's going to hold your interest. It's quite a gripping narrative, as you'll see. And here's H.L. Hicks reading, "Even be it built of boards planed by hand and joined without nails, yet may a barn burn."
The three men now stood satisfied, arms crossed, joking among themselves, but only moments before they hadn't been laughing. It had taken all three to bind the struggling man. First, to limit his movement, they had duct-taped his wrists together behind his back. For that, one man had held his legs and another had pinned him, one hand on each shoulder blade and one knee on his head, at his left temple, grinding his right cheek and eye into the dust and straw and dried shit that formed the floor of the barn. More tape over his mouth, wound all the way around his head, three full loops, much more than was necessary, which was one thing they were laughing about, the two bigger men making fun of the smaller one, who had done that part of the binding. Then they'd bound him down on the mattress, again with the tape. The bound man continued to struggle, but once the tape denied him movement, he felt as if he were thinking clearly, as if his panic had lifted, resistance become mere obligation. He thought surely the tape would run out, but they had another roll just in case. He noticed the new order, head first this round, when it came to the mattress. One man would lift one end just off the dirt, enough for another to wrap the tape, which cursed coming off the roll in what the man construed as sympathy, all the way around the mattress in loops that included his head and neck, then the same process at the other end, all the way around the mattress and his ankles. They couldn't figure out how to get the tape around his torso because it was so near the middle of the mattress. The bound man found himself wanting to help, but of course he couldn't speak, and anyway they didn't need his advice. His hands bound behind his back and against the mattress meant his feet and head, and most of all his neck, were plenty to keep him from getting loose and grabbing one of their guns. The bound man's life didn't pass before him in summary exactly, but he did see things now that in all these years he hadn't noticed. The wiring, for instance. He thought it must have been his own father who'd wired the barn, with that odd blend of pride and makeshift half-competence that showed up in all his father'd made, himself not least. One bare bulb bragging from the highest joist about its white porcelain fixture, but better really at casting long shadows than at lighting the place. Though if the three men would just leave him alone, he thought, he'd be able to count up all the birds' nests and speculate on where swallows had built before there were barns. The wire ran from switchbox to fixture in straight lines and right angles, through half-inch galvanized, surely intended for plumbing, but good, too, for frustrating the rats. It was the short man, the one who'd done all the taping, who then poured kerosene across the mattress and over the man, soaking his clothes, making sure to splash some into his eyes. No one else noticed, but he spelled out "fuck" with the kerosene, or anyway swung his arms in that pattern. That was when they could relax a little, the three men, and start their joking once the kerosene was poured. One tall man slapped his forehead. You brought matches, right? Matches, the other replied, furrowing his brow and patting his pockets, and both laughed out loud. Even the short man smiled. Barns burn, it turns out, just the way you'd think if you thought about it. Hay fast and hot, siding lighting the roof and the flooring of the loft, all the slender strips of wood with the few parts not tinder, the frame, the beams and joists, starting last and lasting longest. But that's not what the mattress-bound man's great-great-grandfather had thought about. It's someday burning, as he built the barn. He had a daughter to worry about, and a wife big with what he thought might be a boy. And weather, and a dozen cows. Plenty to fret, more immediate than which fuck-up would later taint his bloodline and preside over the decay, finally inviting the sacrifice of what he had built to last. Barns burn like bonfires built for the burning, stacked just so by one mortal for the next. They burn best at night, whether or not communicants travel up and down billows lit silver from above, red from below, and whether or not three men have stopped among sycamores on the rise just opposite and turned for a moment to admire their handiwork.
Well, that's a striking poem, I think. It's a, you know, it's a sort of cross between Quentin Tarantino and William Faulkner.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know, Kathy Park Hung was taking this Western landscape and making something, you know, a formal experiment out of it. But here H.L. Hicks is doing something that seems to be getting rarer and rarer these days, and that is creating a narrative poem, something that has prose-like qualities. And in fact, this seems to have started out as a prose piece, but then it has been morphed into something that has the qualities of a poem, the mm-hmm. music that moves you along.
And he says he's not so interested in plot, right?
He's more
interested in setting, character, machinery, and motive, as he puts it.
I'm interested in getting in people's heads when they're not doing what is expected of them, when they're not feeling what they're supposed to feel.
You would think that somebody being duct taped to a mattress and about to be lit on fire would you would hear the experience of terror in this, but it's a very calm narrative. It's got the calming narrative voice going.
Yeah, which is it's unnerving, actually. Somehow, for me, it makes it more terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, a movie couldn't do this. You know,
right. Tarantino would have to show the blood and guts.
Right.
And
we're
fire.
Inside the guy's head and so inside the scene that he distills that terror in a way. And there are these odd details that come off, and they stick out precisely because the narrative is so plain-spoken and linear. For instance, that tape which cursed coming off the roll in what the man construed as sympathy. A wonderful detail. You hear duct tape, that sound that it makes when you're taking it off, and it's he hears it as a cursing.
Yeah. That's one of the great things that a narrative poem can do, is sort of slow down the action and become reflective. So that here, what's bound up in all this stuff is the history of the barn, the man who made it, and the dreams that he had for the people who are going to live in it and come after him.
And so he's got his father there, and you can't help but hear Frost, you know, where he says, one bare bulb, he looks up, and what he sees is one bare bulb bragging from the highest joist about its white porcelain fixture, but better really at casting long shadows than at lighting the place. That's something you'd come across in a Robert Frost poem.
That's really true. It's got that weird violence that Frost has, too, the kind of animus and animosity that's built into the narrative.
Yeah.
I think what also happens is that so many times poems are things that bind up fragments, the kind of fragmentary experiences we have. And here, these long narrative lines, and indeed the length of the whole poem, kind of suspend the fragments in a larger framework so that they start to make a deep intuitive sense.
You know, narrative poems, they're out of fashion these days. And some people go so far as to criticize them, say that they don't fairly represent the world that we live in. If you tell a linear story, it's different from the world that we all inhabit. So we asked H.L. Hicks, you know, why he would write a narrative poem now.
I'm skeptical of the sense that somehow our lives are somehow more fragmentary, more disorienting than, you know, lives were 150 years ago or 400 years ago or whenever. And it seems to me that we continue to pursue narrative impulses as a way of contesting that fragmentariness. You don't have to believe that you will resolve the fragmentariness to want to contest it anyway and to employ narrative as a means of contesting that fragmentariness, of trying to put your life together in some way, trying to understand your life in terms according to which your life is meaningful.
That's a good quote.
It is a good quote, yeah. It makes me think of E.O. Wilson, the biologist, who said that great minds either they see disorder and they create order, or they see order and they create disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that H.L. Hicks is experiencing the world as disorder, but he wants to create order out of it.
Yeah. I think Wilson's just done a novel, hasn't he?
Has he really?
Called Anthill.
Is that right?
It's a novel
that's
about an ant.
Yeah, that's his life's work, looking at ants, you know, and seeing that humans are like the ants.
There's narrative everywhere.
That poem will be included in H.L. Hicks's book, First Fire, Then Birds, New and Selected Poems, to be published by Etruscan Press later this year.
You can read that poem by H.L. Hicks and everything else you've heard on this program in the April issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Christian Wyman.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.